Okay, thanks. So yeah, I'd like to tell you about work that's been going on in grid computing. It's something that probably most of you have heard of and probably would prefer not to deal with, but part of my message is going to be that it's actually coming and you're going to have to deal with it. So I want to let you know what you're in for and what it promises to do for you and what it's not doing for anyone right now. But So let me just get it up front. And I'd like to start off things with a non sequitur. So this is actually a talk kind of about community building. And to that effort, we've had a workshop in Mexico last year, which is, I think, very successful. We had people from about a dozen groups together to get together to try to compare results and methods for evolution systems. And I think it was a very nice workshop. And there's going to be another one as a follow-on to that in December. And maybe I'll let Miguel, or I'll force Miguel, to stand up and say a word or two about it.
And the format is pretty much the same format we have last year, where we have the first week there will be talks, and the second week will be more dedicated to people who actually sit down and work together. The idea is to have ideas about how to compare different formulations of the equations and keep going with the different programs. Try to compare the use of the same data space as possible, written with some codes. So the idea is just to get more information about what the difference of the different formulations, which I think is a very important problem today. Anyway, welcome. Don't be worried if you are not using taxes. I think that's not going to be an issue at all. It doesn't matter which code you're using. As long as we can sort of read the same sort of data set, I think it'll be okay. And that's the whole idea, to bring everybody together, not just the people who like this code and like that code.
And we've scheduled an organizational meeting Thursday at 10 o'clock. So anyone's welcome to join us. I guess we can meet tentatively in this room.
Okay, good. Okay, so I have two points in my opening slide here, which are, first of all, it's about technology, and the thing that you probably heard about that's coming very soon is called the TerraGrid. And so the NSF has decided that grid computing is how you're going to do your computing in the near future, and so this is one problem, because no one's really ready for it yet. Another thing is, it's, as I say, it's a lot about community building, and there's a project that we have in Europe called the EU Astrophysics Network, which has about 10 cooperating sites, and there's a follow-on project called GWEN that we've just submitted that has about 20 cooperating sites, and this group is going to very much need to have grid technologies to do the kind of work that they want to do together. So it's supposed to be about enabling technologies to have communities be able to work together and to use their technologies as if you didn't care what machine you were on. You don't even have to know, in principle. You don't even have to know your login for a particular machine in the grand vision of the grid. I just say, I wore a special shirt today, which is this shirt. Some people say I'm put on my grid hat, but this is my grid shirt. I actually have a grid shirt. The Global Grid Forum, the GGF. So I'm a member of that. I went to this thing about 3 years ago, maybe the first meeting that I attended, so-called Global Grid Forum, and I realized that there was nobody there. There were a lot of computer scientists there thinking of all the infrastructure they'd build, but there was nobody there who had any idea what they would do with it. So I thought that was very dangerous. So I founded a thing called the Applications Research Group, and then naturally I had to become the chairman of it. And so the point is, if any of you have ideas or would like to help influence the computer science community on what they're building and what you think would actually be useful, you have a forum for doing that. Okay. Jimmy knows you can do this with Keynote, right? But not with PowerPoint. Yeah, this is Keynote.
Oh, man, you're
all right. All right, grid computing. So what is it? What is it that's really relevant for us? So you can think of it as computation resources scattered around the world and then communities that try to somehow take advantage of it. And you should remember that there are lots and lots of things, and actually many of them are actually powerful enough to be useful for the kind of work we want to do, whether it's compute servers like very large-scale Linux clusters, handheld devices, file servers, networks, PlayStation, cell phones, many small devices, and I'll show you an example later where we just for fun showed that we could compute things on a Sony PlayStation without really caring whether it was a PlayStation or a Cray T3e. The code runs on it just the same. I'll show you an example if I have time at the end. But there's one important thing to note, that is that compute servers are doubling in power every 18 months, as you know from Moore's Law, but networks are doubling every 9 months. And this is crossing over, which means the network is becoming increasingly irrelevant over time. And so think about the limit of network bandwidth going up very high and compute servers then being effectively as close as you want. So then, therefore, the issues about communications and latencies with various techniques are going away. So you could think about harnessing many computers around the world for a problem that you want. And we heard yesterday from Shibata that we need a hypercomputer. Well, in a sense, the grid is going to be the version of the hypercomputer, whatever that is. So we want to harness this for scientific simulations. That's the key thing. So why should we care? As I want to really point out, ready or not, here it comes. The NSF has decreed that your next computer will be the TerraGrid, and there's a $65 million Linux cluster, which is distributed across four sites. I can show you from the previous slide. I guess I don't have another slide that describes this. You probably can't see this very well because it's dark, but it is a very large Linux cluster that's distributed across Argonne, NCSA, Caltech, and San Diego. And it has a very high-speed network, 40 gigabit backplane that connects the four machines. And they want applications to run on this, and you will have to have what's called a grid certificate in order even to log on to it when it's deployed fully. So I'll explain what that is in a few minutes. Larry is only peripherally involved in it. He's thinking beyond the TerraGrid, of course, you know. He has this thing called the Optiputer, which is, I'm not sure how it's really different, but it's going to use optical networks.
If it's inserted in your body and you turned it on, your doctor reads it out and tells you you're sick, come in quickly.
Right. Right, okay. So another reason why this is very interesting, so I just want to point this out, you're going to need a grid certificate fairly soon, within a year, if you want to use the thing. Funding, get it while it's hot, because it is really hot right now. And if you're looking for sources of funding, both the NSF and the DOE and also NASA and in the European area, the European Commission and other funding agencies are pouring hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars into this research. And there are computer scientists out there who are looking for something useful to do, and they want to pair up with applications people. So there's really a lot of funding right now, and I've never seen a time when computer scientists and computational scientists could really work together as well as they can right now. Collaborations, this is really what it's about, I think, building the kind of community that we need. And as I say, the computer science colleagues really want to be useful. And we kind of remember this from those of us who were involved in the Black Hole Grand Challenge project. But at that time, it wasn't the infrastructure and the communities, I think, weren't really mature enough to take the advantage of it the way they will be able to in the future. So in the next generation, I think these things will go much better. And I just want to say, I really do think we need this. So let me give an example. This is a black hole simulation that Miguel must have talked about on Monday, the so-called PriusGo 3. And this is a different visualization probably of it. You can see excision regions going on in here expanding. The black holes coalesce, and then a larger excision region develops. And the gravitational waves here shown as psi 4 are emanating out from this simulation or from this black hole merger. Now, this is a monstrous simulation that we did. And it was really a pain in the neck to do that. We ran on the Platinum cluster at NCSA, 1,024 processors. But when you wake up in the morning, you want to do a simulation, you may have access to resources all over the place. So the first question is, which one do you want to use? Which has the best chance of getting your answer back tomorrow? The Platinum cluster is often not that one, very often, because it's either very busy or somehow it fails for some reason. So you want to find some kind of a software environment that can, if you could specify a problem, it could tell you, based on queues and reliability and so forth, this is the place where you should run, and it could in fact automatically route your job there without your having to know anything about your local login. Many of us have allocations at different sites, and yet we tend to use the one we used yesterday. And so this is a major sort of goal of grid computing, how to distribute your work effectively across the resources that you have. Another thing is, you typically generate huge amounts of data at any one site. So in this case, we did generate about a terabyte of data, and then we were living in Berlin and our data was in Champaign, so we had to send people there actually and sit there at a supercomputer and visualize that for about 3 weeks and bring back the data on disks. And so that's not really what we want. So we have to develop technology so you can remote access your data very conveniently, and whether it's a terabyte or 10 terabytes or just a few gigabytes. Many components are needed to do a simulation like that. So you need to have different equation solvers, you need to have different initial value solvers, you need different evolution systems, different gauge conditions. If you're doing hydro codes, equation of state, etc., horizon finders. And typically, as we know, these are very large things that take months or years to develop each individual component. So somehow we have to find a way to bring these communities together and allow them to build components that interoperate with each other. And so the grid is trying to develop an environment where this becomes easier. And I think, as I'll say again later, the hardest part is going to be in the sociology, not in the technology, of making that possible. So while you're running a simulation, you may discover that you need something that you didn't anticipate. For example, you have two neutron stars colliding and a black hole formed, but you didn't think that was going to happen. So you might want to load a component on the fly, for example. And this is the kind of thing where, with grid technologies, you'll be able to find services that are out there if they've been properly coded and registered, and then invoke them on the fly. Your computations change with time. So you have adaptive mesh codes. You may start off needing a few gigabytes of memory and end up needing terabytes of memory because you've allocated lots and lots of grids. So you may need to actually move your code to another machine, a larger machine, or somehow distribute it dynamically across multiple machines. That's the kind of vision that they have in mind for the TerraGrid. But while this is happening, of course, you have to be monitoring this, and there have to be sort of ways to let people know when their code is doing something on the fly. If it decides to move from NCSA to San Diego because there's more memory available there, and these are kinds of scenarios that they have in mind, then you have to be notified about that. And then later, how do we interact with experiments? So you could imagine, for example, with advanced gravitational wave detectors, they may have tunable bandwidths, and they may see some kind of a signal, and by interacting with simulations that are going on, you may be able to say, if you tuned your detector in this range, then you'll have a better chance of seeing that signal. These are kinds of things that in the next decade people are actually thinking about, but our community is a bit behind. There are lots of other communities where they have in mind live simulations that have to be done on very short timescales that will be interacting with data that are being collected by sensors all around the world. So all of this kind of stuff is coming. So you might say, well, what's the difference between the grid and what we've had for a long time? So we've had networks connected by computers for 20 years. We've had web services for 5 or 10 years. And the grid combines these things and then brings additional notions, which are, for example, virtual organizations, which I'll talk about in a minute. Which is a sort of software technology and of a groups of people that cooperate using the technologies that are deployed across all of the sites in the grid world. Infrastructure to enable computation to be carried out across all of these different sites. And then things like authentication, monitoring, information, resource discovery, status information, coordination between sites and codes and people. The grid is providing infrastructure to allow people to do all of these things much more easily. So you might ask, then, can I just plug my application into the grid? And the answer is definitely no. There's a lot of work that has to be done to get there. But even now, I'll show you some examples of what we can do in sort of prototype form. And even the most trivial level, if you had just an executable that runs on under Linux, some version of Red Hat, or just typically Linux, then you can run across a number of different sites, and there are resource brokering technologies being deployed across the Alliance and San Diego, the PACI, NPACI program, and so on, where you'll simply be able to submit a request and your job will get farmed out somewhere. And you shouldn't really care where. So what are the components you need for grid computing? All of these, the problem with the grid is you need a lot of stuff and everything, all of it has to work in order for your application to actually execute. And so you need to have communities that cooperate, you need to have resources, you need to have this infrastructure, grid services, and then applications ultimately that are uniquely, that sort of been retooled to be able to take advantage of the grid. And I'm going to go through each of these and show you in a nutshell what's being done. So, interoperability, that is a key concept for the grid, and I think it's a key problem that we have in our community also. Try to build things that interoperate with each other. So this just what we want in this room, I think, is some kind of, well, this is an overused word, but seamless interconnectivity. We know nothing is really plug and play, even on a Macintosh. So on the grid, they're trying to apply this concept to a much more unwieldy set of computers around the world, but they're making a lot of progress. So the grid technologies are aimed at providing services and interfaces to enable this kind of interoperability at many levels. So software and code, well, there will be components that can announce themselves through information servers and say, I have this kind of capability, I have this kind of file format. Yeah, Jim? Means if you have, if I have a data analysis package and you've generated some data, then I ought to just be able to read it without having to worry about the details of it. Or if someone's developed an apparent horizon finder and I've generated some data in my numerical code, I ought to just be able to use it with some kind of standard interface so they interoperate with each other. That's what I mean. But then this doesn't just lie at the level of codes, it lies at the level of software components and services. So for example, there'll be information servers that I'll tell you about that will be able you'll be able to query them with a standard web browser, any web browser, and it will be able to tell you what's the status of all the resources that it knows about, and it'll tell you about all of your jobs that might be running. And so this should happen whether it's running on a grid in Europe, Japan, or America. It shouldn't make any difference. And so the interfaces and the service architecture for this are all being put in place over the last couple of years and probably for the next couple of years as well. And then, of course, people need to be interoperable, which they're typically not. So that's, I keep saying, is the hardest part. I want to point out one thing, is that people can share their tools, but you can still do your own physics. So if you develop a tool, let's say the world's best apparent horizon finder, you can use it for your own, but it would be nice if you let other people use it, and they're not necessarily going to get a jump on you. You'll get credit for that if you publish the paper on that, and then you should let other people use it. Or if they don't trust it, they might look at it and maybe learn something from it. So I think we somehow need to get beyond the my code mentality and think about using it for physics. All right. So the whole grid is really teeming with different communities now that are trying to take advantage of it. I'll give you a few examples later, but the earthquake modeling community, climate modeling communities, plasma physicists, number of astrophysical communities, and so on. And they all realize that they can't solve problems alone. So these communities can be very diverse. They tend to have experimentalists, computer scientists, simulation people, network researchers who are worried about how to minimize latencies and maximize bandwidths, and they all need to work together somehow to solve these problems. And they have very different kinds of resources. So, for example, across the world, there are many different computers and networks, and we want them to look the same. So we just don't want to have to learn somebody's local batch system or operating system, or even to have to worry about what's my login on that machine. There's software being deployed now that should hide those kinds of details. And so the grids are enabling people effectively to bring all of these things together and then to cooperate. And they form what's called a virtual organization. So let me describe that in a little more detail. So virtual organizations are collections of people and machines and networks or archives, file systems, etc. at different sites. And this is a notion that's emerged in the last few years in the grid community. And it has, if you look at the Globus website, it's called www.globus.org, you can find out more technical definitions of this stuff. So it actually has a strong computer science underpinning. But effectively, for our purposes, they're just groups of organizations that want to use some resources for specific purposes. And they typically deploy the same software technology, not hardware. So that should become irrelevant in this picture. So, for example, deploy a directory service. That would be that knows about all resources within its domain. So there's a thing called the MDS, the Monitoring Discovery Service. And so resources are registered with this system, the MDS, and they can be discovered on the fly. So you could put in a request. In fact, your code could be running and decide it needs to do something that's going to slow down the main code, so it could spawn off a smaller job, let's say to find a horizon on the fly, and you don't want to slow down your code. You could look for a service while you're running, and then it could find that service and then take advantage of it on the fly with this kind of infrastructure that would be deployed. And if you want to look slightly more technical acronyms here, you know, computer scientists love these things. The GIS, the Grid Index Information Service, provides information for an entire virtual organization. So we could define one for numerical relativity, for example. We're going to define one for a project, the GWEN project that I mentioned, the sort of EU astrophysics network project in Europe, and where we have partnerships with computer grid projects. We'll define portals to our resources, so with a web browser we can find wherever we want. We can share code easily with each other. Yeah, Joan. Right.
So, what's going on in security?
There's a. So yeah, there's a fundamental tension between what we want to do in the grid and then what we have to do to protect ourselves and with security. And so basically, there are mechanisms in place with certificates, so-called grid certificates, that allow you to log in securely but yet conveniently at all of these sites. Right. So some of these organizations have tighter security with firewalls around them. Within NASA, they have what's called the Information Power Grid that's run by Bill Johnston. And so they have, within NASA, it's very convenient to move things around. And NASA, on the other hand, is not allowing people from the outside to just go in and take care of their resources. But people are looking at punching sort of secure holes in firewalls that allow these specific kinds of operations to take place. Yeah, so it's a big problem. It's the fundamental reason why, I'm going to show you some prototypes in a few minutes, why they don't work in the real world very much right now, because there's too much security around those sites.
It's not that there's too much security, there are too many hackers.
Well, okay, yeah, ultimately that's the problem. Okay, so I mean, there's not enough security from many people's points of view, and they're right from that perspective. All right. So the point is that people or applications are going to be able to search these information servers for information, and then they can take advantage of it in some way. Okay? So sometimes, well, so I'll get to this authentication issue. There's things called certificates in a grid map file. So you get what's called a certificate, which is an encrypted file that says who you are, and you have to basically show some kind of identification to the agency that gives you the certificate. So, for example, NCSA will hand out certificates, and it's kind of lax. So anybody in Europe who says, who I say is okay, actually can get a certificate from NCSA. So that's a little bit dangerous. But so they're working on procedures to enable this. But once you get a certificate, then basically you go to a site, and that certificate then is, once the certificate is unique identification for you, and then you are mapped onto a local user ID by the so-called grid map file, and so with that certificate you can get in without having to invoke a local password. And that's the idea. The certificate is the key thing, and this is the mechanism that people have agreed upon in the grid world. So that has a huge advantage for you, because if you have accounts on 16 computers and you get fed up with trying to remember your user ID and password on all of them, one certificate will get you into any of them. Okay? And it's also dangerous, and you can't give your certificate to anybody else. But, I mean, in practice you could. But in practice, in reality, you shouldn't do that. But there's a problem here. So far, there is no global grid information index server that links together all virtual organizations. And ultimately, that probably won't happen, but there will be interagency cooperation between NSF, NASA, DOE, and European sites for sure, and Asia Pacific. They're working on that now. Okay, so if we had the right kind of environment, and this is the kind of thing I've always dreamed of, wouldn't it be nice if Dennis could find and use Greg's new initial data. I like Greg's initial data a lot. It'd be nice if we could just sort of find Greg's initial data, black hole initial data server, and import that into our code. Of course, you wouldn't do that until you were ready to do that. But at some point, you'd want people to use your stuff. And this is one big difference between, say, our community and the computer science community. The computer science community, a measure of success is, does someone actually use something they developed? Okay, and so therefore they work very hard to make it interoperable to other people's services and so on. Our community has been more closed in the past, but it would be a nice measure of success if, say, you know, if everybody wanted to use Greg's initial data server, then he would feel like he'd really done something and he would get a lot of credit for that. And so on and so on. So it would be nice if Greg could use Jonathan's new Apparent Horizon Finder. He's developed a wonderful new Apparent Horizon Finder, and he's going to make it publicly available over the summer. Sasha could use Peter Diener's new Event Horizon Finder. In fact, he can do that because they're working in the same building together. I'd love to use Shibata's evolution code because it looks great. It's probably a lot better than ours, or at least we could learn something from it if this were available. Or Jimmy could examine one of our black hole evolution runs that has data sitting in Berlin, but he could do it from Cornell. And with these kinds of services, it should be easy to do that if we just agree to do that once the infrastructure is in place. Or John Baker could run a Lazarus-style extended evolution of one of Shibata's merged neutron stars. Yesterday, I was thinking it would be nice to see those waveforms coming out. And if we could cooperate in the right way, taking advantage of this kind of infrastructure, those things can happen more easily, let's say. Or any one of you could monitor one of our latest black hole simulations live. And I'll show you an example of how we're doing that within our own group now. So the grid is providing an environment where this becomes easier through these things called virtual organizations and something I'll just mention called OGSA, the Open Grid Services Architecture, that all the sites around the world, basically all of them, are building on top of. So the biggest problem will be getting people to agree to do it. It certainly can. It can do that. Someone has to write that service, you see, that's all. That is a very good idea. Okay, so this is just a little more proselytizing, but we have this project that I mentioned called Gwen, and it's going to be very much a sharing collaboration between these 20 groups. That is, any group, every group has agreed to share their codes with every other one, but of course, when they're ready to. That doesn't mean immediately, but when they think it's safe to use and they've gotten some research results out of it. So the idea is sharing of expertise. That's one thing that a computational community can do. Sharing of code among all groups, so infrastructure, black hole routines are developed that apply directly to neutron star work and so on. For example, new gauge conditions for co-rotation will work in both cases. Why bother reinventing the wheel all the time? But there's some important points about this. If you do this, it encourages better code, a lot better, because if you know somebody's going to look at it, you're going to be a lot more careful in how you coded it in the first place. It encourages documentation, and it encourages a much deeper level of thinking about how your code might interface with somebody else's. It also produces more trusted code, because if someone's going to be looking at your code and you know there are certain test beds that it should pass and so on, the other people are going to trust your code a lot more, and therefore your results, if they've been able to take a look at it themselves. And then improvements can propagate more quickly through a community, and also bugs. But if we have test suites, we should be able to guard ourselves against that. So we will be building a virtual organization for this Gwen project. And by the way, so this project is still under review, but I feel pretty confident about it getting funded. Okay, so software infrastructure, there are different kinds of things, and more or less I've talked about them, but here I kind of categorize them. So there's low-level infrastructure being deployed. Fundamental technologies needed to build the grids, so things that handle security, logins, and data transfer between sites. Communication between different computers different kinds of mechanisms. So you could stream data from one to another. You could just FTP a file or secure copy it. Or you could do a thing called GSI FTP, which is a grid security infrastructure version of FTP that's now deployed in many sites, which uses your certificate, so you don't have to know anything about your remote login if you have the certificate. Information and generally grid services. Then on top of this, there are going to be middleware services, so data movers. So for example, you might want to move a file from site A to site B, and your code might want to, in fact, do that as part of an operation while it's running to maybe retrieve a data file from one site and bring it there. But in advance, you might not know what service is actually there. Is it going to be just the GSI FTP command? Is it going to be the secure copy command? Or is it going to be just CP? Maybe you don't have any local grid infrastructure deployed. So there will be these services that will say, what mechanism can I use to move a file from point A to point B? It will find that, and then it will do it. So your codes can be very portable and very flexible when you have this kind of environment. Okay, and then application monitoring systems. So these will be middleware services built on top of all these things. And then on top of this, there's a project that we're involved in Europe called the Grid Lab project, and I'll say just a few words at the end here about it, where we're developing application toolkits so that in any code that you're developing, you'll be able to call grid services, either to find information or to do things, without having to know any of the details. And so your code will be able to communicate with other code, find services, and do things like that on its own, or to ask you to intervene. All right. So there's a thing called open grid services architecture that was just revealed about a little over a year ago by the Argonne Group, and now the Grid Forum, which has about 1,000 people attending now every year, and it's a killer because it meets 3 times a year in different countries, so it means a lot of travel. But basically everybody in that organization is just completely dedicated to this now. They're writing all kinds of services. It'll be deployed at NCSA. This is going to be a big thing coming up. So let me just move ahead a bit to say what kinds of things we'll be able to do with grid-aware applications. So think beyond just getting your existing code to run someplace conveniently. That's a big step forward, and we're not there yet. But think a little bit further ahead. If you had some kind of a toolkit where that you could plug your scientific engine or engineering application into it, then that that application could either provide it a grid service, it could register itself as a grid service, and could say, I can do the following things if you want to, which it could be like find event horizons or apparent horizons. So for our community, we could define a virtual organization that had those kinds of services. And it will be easy to use in the sense that you'll automatically find these kinds of resources given a need. So for example, if you have a laptop with wireless networking, you open it up and it just finds a local wireless network, right? And it just works. And we'll have the same kind of capabilities with our applications. So you may have things, for example, given some need, you'll find some resources. You may have examples where you want to run across multiple computers. You have a distributed simulation. Use as many machines as needed. With bandwidths going up so fast, that'll be very not only possible but practical. Remote visualization and steering and tracking to watch what happens with your code and taking advantage of this. So for example, these hypothetical examples would be Jonathan's service or maybe Greg's initial value binary black hole service. So I just want to point out, a lot of other communities are recognizing this, and they're getting tens of millions of dollars to work on this, and so our community should be thinking about this as well. So what it means for us is that there's a grand vision for the future, which is that you'll be able to collect these resources around the world into virtual organizations. Hopefully it'll be easy to access them with a single sign-on. You'll have new applications that can do new things. But right now, it's quite frustrating. So all of this stuff sort of works, but it doesn't work reliably, and people are still afraid to really use it. But it's primarily because the stuff is not fully deployed. It's not because it fundamentally doesn't work. So that's the big problem, the deployment issue. And it's not even consistent across a single virtual organization. So within the Alliance, for example, different people at different sites have different versions of Globus installed. That's the basic infrastructure that you probably heard of. And they're not compatible with each other. And so there are stupid things like this that are preventing it from really working properly. All right. So let me give you just a couple of examples. A project called GridLab, which we're involved in Europe, which is led by a guy named Jarek Nabryski in Poland. It's about 5 million euros. Has a bunch of different institutes, including 3 American ones and a couple of computer companies. And we're doing everything from developing the infrastructure underneath to toolkits at the top and anyone and everything in between, basically. And we have 2 main application areas, numerical relativity and gravitational wave data analysis. And so we have participants from, say, Cardiff and AEI and many sites like that. So let me give you a few examples then of what's been developed now that sort of works. Okay, so accounts for one user. This is one of my students, I think it's Gerd Lonfermann who made up this slide, has accounts on all of these machines with all these different user IDs and passwords, and what you really want is just a portal. You go to a web browser and says, these are your personal resources and just want to get a job running on one of them. So with your certificate, you'll be able to have a single way of accessing all of those resources to locate or build your executables, to find parameter files. Maybe you're sharing them with people across your virtual organization. That will be very easy to do with this kind of thing. Then to submit your job. It doesn't matter which one of these machines runs your job as long as you get the answer back. And so wherever it goes, you should be notified that it's going there. And you should be able to do this from a web browser without any hassles. And so here's an example of a web portal that was developed by the so-called ASC project. That's a project funded by the NSF that's led by Waimo Suen at WashU. And so there's been a portal, among other things, that have been developed, and it works nicely, but the infrastructure that it sits on top of is not fully deployed everywhere, so we're not really using it for production, but we're trying to get there. Once jobs start running, you want to be able to connect into them. So there are ways now, with appropriate holes in firewalls or secure grid environments, where you can connect to running simulations and they provide services. So for example, right now our codes provide information servers that you can connect to from any web browser, and you can see the exact status of your code. You can find out all the routines that are compiled in, what parameter files are being used, which ones are active, what data are being written. You can get crude visualizations directly within the web browser. You can also then access them from other portable devices. So we actually did demos where we had codes running that sent SMS messages to your cell phone to say that two black holes had just collided, a common horizon had been found. These kinds of things are possible. So if you really care about your simulations, you'll want to know if that happened or if your code crashed. What if your code crashed and you spent a week preparing for it, and 2 days later you didn't know? You check and you wasted a week. I mean, this kind of stuff you get instant notification of. You can also have data that are streamed securely across sockets to be able to visualize them remotely. That is, if you're sitting in Berlin and your calculation's running at NCSA, you can visualize them with your favorite Viz client through this interoperable mechanism. We're using a version of HDF5, if some of you know what that is, and we've modified it to allow streaming, or to do, say, really high-quality visualization. So this is a bit of a fantasy right now, but we're getting ever closer to being able to see these kinds of evolutions going on live while your black hole codes are running. Okay, so another thing is interacting with remote data. So this thing where we had to fly people off to NCSA to visualize the data was a killer, and we shouldn't ever have to do that again. So we've developed the ability, using again grid technology. See, let's say you were at NCSA, you wrote a terabyte file. You're sitting in Berlin and you want to do an analysis of that. So rather than flying there, you want to just be able to go in, find out information about that particular data file, and just by querying that using a grid version of a thing called Grid FTP that's now connected into HDF, you can then selectively download what you want without having to bring the whole file across. So for example, you can bring that across. If you're sitting, we did a demo at Supercomputing in Baltimore this year where we queried a remote data file in Berlin from Baltimore, and then we were able to downsample it in some way. And a feature that's coming is it will automatically be able to sense the bandwidth using a network monitoring service and then give you the data you want with a sort of a human response time of, say, 2 or 3 seconds. It'll give you whatever data it can give that you'll be able to see in a few seconds. So that's the idea, so you can speed up the access to these things. All right. So let me just conclude with a couple of more futuristic examples. We've done a thing a couple of years ago at Supercomputing where we did spawning. So we had a black hole simulation running in Potsdam. And every time it wanted to find our parent horizon, which is a pretty slow process, except now that Jonathan has a faster horizon finder, but it's a slow process. So we'd say, let's find a horizon, but let's first find a place where we could do it so it doesn't get done on the main simulation, doesn't slow us down. And we actually, by querying an information server, we could find these various sites that we'd set up in advance that could find horizons for us. And the data were streamed over there. And every time a horizon was found, every time a horizon was desired to be found, well, here, I've lost my track of my thing, we spawned it off to a remote site. And this actually works. 2 years ago, something could be done in production within a couple of years, I'm sure. All right. So we did one more example I'll show you, if you indulge me for a minute or two, at Supercomputing this year. A thing called the Global Grid Testbed Collaboration. So we assembled a huge grid across 5 continents and 14 countries, and we had over 7,500 processors, including our favorite one, which is the Sony PlayStation 2 in Manchester. And it has Linux, and it runs the Globus Toolkit on it, and we were able to spawn jobs off to it without even knowing that it was a Sony PlayStation 2. And then it announced itself to our portal, so we could actually visualize the simulation it was doing live, and this is all done automatically. So we did a pretty cool simulation where we had a big job running. This is one of our production black hole simulations running on Seaborg, the machine at NERSC, and it does task farming now to adjust various parameters, particularly the so-called co-rotation parameters. So I guess Miguel talked about this, where the black holes, we go into a co-rotating frame, but you're always kind of guessing what's the right value of the co-rotating frame. So we spawn off dozens of smaller jobs that could then test various co-rotation parameters and then find out which one seemed to be the best, and they'd get spawned off to these grid resources around the world, and then they'd come back, the results would come back, and they'd say this parameter was best from this time step to this time step, so it would be steered in that way. And every time this happens, you get notified that something has happened, including on your cell phone. So this is kind of an extreme version of the cool technology you can have, but this is all actually working in prototype form now. So, we're building a thing called the Grid Toolkit that's going to allow you to program your codes to do this. I mean, it's not a cactus thing. You might notice I haven't said the word cactus yet until now. So none of this has anything to do with cactus. And so I just want to conclude by saying, imagine a new kind of computing, and this is the world that the grid environment, the grid community is trying to build for us, where the code or the user or the infrastructure is aware of the environment and is querying to find out what services are available, what's available now, and are they up, are they down, what's the bandwidth, what's the allocation on those sites. The code or the user or some infrastructure monitoring should be able to make decisions. Can your code have things that could be spawned off asynchronously, or are new, more powerful resources available? Maybe you should move there. Or maybe you're using a machine that you're hogging up a whole machine, you don't need it. You could go to a smaller one. Things like this. So, let's just say, I'll just close here with a little commentary and summary, that the grid is coming, whether you're liking it or not, and many people are being dragged kicking and screaming into it, but there's sort of there's no alternative right now, because that's what's coming. It has a lot of potential, so I just say we should take advantage of it. And there's a lot of funding, that's potential. There's community infrastructure. Computer science colleagues are dying to have people to work with so they don't just solve toy problems. It's very crude right now, but it can already do amazing things. And I think those of us who worked in the Grand Challenge know that there were a lot of problems in it. I think the primary one was that there was no collaborative infrastructure in place, and now that problem is being solved. And secondly, that it was really a community building project, and I think people didn't fundamentally understand that, but they will in the future, I'm sure.
I mean, all that hell we went through was helpful.
It was very helpful. I learned a lot of lessons from that. All right. I know. Okay, that's all. Thanks.
Using this grid and competing for the same resources, so what's the scheme for prioritizing all the jobs from all these different people? I mean, is that trivial or...?
It depends. So there are, of course, global schedulers being developed that are sort of meta-schedulers, so they just deal with all the local schedulers. And there are mechanisms being devised for that. But primarily, the problems aren't so bad as they seem, because you'll define these virtual organizations, and then you'll have resources at your own disposal. You'll have applied for grants and computer time, and then you can assign those priorities among yourselves more easily. So there are those kinds of things that will be put in place.
So are these virtual organizations, are they going to be anarchies or democracies or dictatorships? I mean, people can't even agree on what to call the lapse and shift right now. And you know, so it just looks a little bit, I'm very curious as an outsider, how you're going to run it. And I'm also serious, because that's what goes wrong with these organizations. You need some way to decide how they're being run.
Right. So the first comment is deciding what you call lapse and shift, that's an issue of interoperability, right? So. But secondly, you have to have somebody who's more or less organizing it. It's not just going to be anarchy. There is a structure that's going to be put in place. And so the organizations have to agree. And they are. So for example, those of you involved in the Griffin project, you're seeing probably a lot of arguments about these things and how they work, but they're going. And the Nice Grid is another example, the earthquake simulation project here. And they have resources, and they're deciding on policies. Well, there's a leader of the project, and they have committees, and then they decide policies, just like they do it at NCSA across the alliance, and then those get implemented. Right. Okay. That's a fair comment.
It seems to me that some kinds of computing problems are more amenable to sort of heterogeneous computing environment than others. For example, if you have a time evolution, you need to advance in an orderly way from one time step to the next. And even on a homogeneous high-end computer, you worry a great deal about load balancing and communication costs, even within a single high-end supercomputer.
Right.
So in for a time evolution type problem where you worry about these things even now, is it realistic that this kind of problem can really be done in a dispersed, heterogeneous computing environment?
Some of them can, and some of them aren't suitable for that. So, I mean, just I skipped over this slide because I didn't have time, but we had one of our production codes running distributed across three origins and an SP at three origins at NCSA and an SP2 at San Diego. And they actually used that to prototype, to collect data that they put in the TerraGrid proposal. And we were able to scale up to something like 70% efficiency. We actually won a thing called the Gordon Bell Prize for that. But it was, the thing is, it was a generic code for solving Einstein's equations. It didn't have some tricky things like input and output turned on, and it didn't have things like elliptic solvers turned on. But so it's an example where you have a hyperbolic sort of explicit time-stepping routine, and you can make it work like that, in fact, efficiently. In other cases where it doesn't work, then you just want to put that on one unit, but you may have other units of work that could be offloaded. Or if even that doesn't work, then the key thing is where should it run of all your resources so you get the fastest answer back. So there are many levels of these things.